My castaway this week is a doctor. He practices in a controversial field, fertility. He was born into a Jewish family in West London, studied medicine, and after a brief spell in the theatre, joined the Hammersmith Hospital, where he's been on and off ever since. In 1981, 3 years after the first so-called test tube baby was born, Hammersmith opened the country's first National Health IVF clinic, and it's from this position that my castaway has campaigned passionately for patients of all kinds, HIV positive, lesbian, widows and lovers, to be allowed to make the babies they want. But he scorns the idea that he's playing God. There's an extraordinary need for what we're doing, he says. It has huge value for mankind's future. He is Professor Robert Winston, Lord Winston, indeed. But, Robert, making people fertile where they are not, surely that is a kind of act of God, isn't it?
Well, the ability to procreate is, I suppose, an act of God. What we're doing is to use the materials of creation. There is a concept that by using the materials of creation, mankind is in the situation of imitatio Dei. He's imitating God, which is seen to be good by Judeo-Christian thought. And indeed, the first commandment in the Bible is, be fruitful and multiply. And it goes on to say, and fill the earth. And then the fourth verb in the Hebrew is, and subdue it. And that's the notion that mankind uses technology to improve his environment, to use it to improve his lot, to improve the quality of life.
So you can imitate God, but you're not supplanting him, that's the point.
Yes, we're not creating from nothing, we're creating from what already exists.
But of course it's your patients who see you as God, isn't it? Because they come to you miserable, in despair, they have only one thing on their mind, which is that they want a baby, and you are seen as the person who can answer their prayers.
And that is actually the most difficult aspect, I think, of the whole work, the idea that people attach much more significance to you than really you justify or can you meet. I mean, basically, I find myself a failure, I mean, frequently with patients because I don't come up to their expectations. Much of the time, I'm telling people that I can't help them. And very often, because people don't want to hear that, you have to tell them that really quite brutally, almost brutally.
I think you've called it yourself an emotional roller coaster, all of this. How much of that emotion rubs off on you?
I find it actually impossible to talk about my clinic.
At home?
Yeah, I never go home with it, ever.
But how can you switch off when you've been
Well, I do things like listen to music, for example, or read a book, or, you know, do something totally different. But I actually don't talk about the medicine at home. I don't mind talking about my science, which is a different compartment, because that isn't anything like as demanding. Although,
but do you think about it? Do these cases...
Yes, I do, and I think of the mistakes I make all the time, actually. I think of the things that I've said to people that I feel perhaps weren't right or not tactful.
Let's hear some of that music that takes you away from it all so well. What's your first record?
Well, the first record is Haydn's Creation. It's got special associations for me because it's the chord when Let There Be Light is the moment of discovery, it's science. And, of course, it's also about fertility, too. It's about Genesis.
Werner Hollweg singing part of Haydn's Creation with the Brighton Festival Chorus and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Antal Doraty.
Yeah, there's a wonderful irony about this because Haydn was in a childless marriage and when the thing was performed, the irony is they shouted, Father Haydn to the front, Father Haydn to the front.
The irony surrounding you is that when IVF treatment first began 18 years, only 18 years ago. It's amazing, isn't it? You were a real Luddite, weren't you? You didn't give it much cop at all.
I've always been pretty stupid about a lot of things, actually, and I've always made errors of judgment of this sort. I mean, I didn't appreciate that in vitro fertilisation could actually be able to work on a broad scale. One was also aware that human embryos don't implant very regularly. I mean, only about 14% of treatment cycles even now produce a baby.
What does that make? So you've got a one in what chance of...
Well, averagely, throughout Britain, in an average unit, you'd have about a 1 in 8 chance, 1 in 9 chance.
But in your
success.
Unit, it's a better chance.
It's a bit better than that at the moment. But
what
I mean,
it
depends so much in fact, success rates can be exaggerated by the nature of who you're treating. If you treat lots of young women, you'll get much better success rates, perhaps 1 in 3. If you treat women in their 40s, then you'll have success rates which are well below 10%.
But I wonder whether reproductive medicine, and as we say, it's moved forward in leaps and bounds over the last 18 years, I wonder whether it hasn't had what you might regard as a negative effect, made women more obsessed by childlessness, more distressed.
I think it's had two major effects, one definitely negative and one definitely positive. The positive side first, I think, is that this was a matter of deep shame. The loss of self-esteem was associated with a complete shut-off privacy. I mean, people who are infertile are angry, dispossessed, and they can't easily talk about it, and the publicity given to in vitro fertilisation has made it much easier for them to discuss it openly. So that's been a really positive benefit.
But my point really is that what happens now as a result of reproductive medicine being there, offering people another chance, if then that fails, then a woman has a double sense of failure because she failed naturally and then she fails artificially.
I think that's perfectly true. I think that it's also partly because we live in a kind of consumer society. We believe we can get anything that is available, and therefore it's difficult to accept that there might be failure. And also there is probably too much expectation of what medicine can offer. I mean, the fact is, medicine doesn't cure disease. It gets ways round it very often, or it palliates it. And you can't cure everybody with infertility.
Record number 2.
Yeah, well, as you probably appreciate it, I'm choosing music, which is related, in my mind, to human reproduction. And the next record is the end of the third act of The Marriage of Figaro, where it seems that the relationship between the Countess and the Count is finally resolved. And then he pricks his finger as he picks up Susanna's letter. And you realise from this little fandango or march that it's actually not resolved at all, and that they're putting a brave face on their relationship, the Count and Countess, just before the wedding.
Ecco la marcia, andiamo ai vostri posti, o bella ai vostri posti. Susanna la mi braccio.
Eccola.
Temerari.
Io son di ghiaccio.
Contessa.
Or non parliamo. Ecco qui le due nozze. Riceverne la mia. Alla fin si tratta d'una vostra protetta.
Se chiamo.
Part of Act 3 of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, with Ruggero Raimondi, Lucia Popp, Barbara Hendricks and José Van Damme, with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. So was the young Robert Winston, West London schoolboy, St Paul's, was he always destined to be a doctor?
No. I mean, my father was... unfortunately, he died when I was quite young.
What did he do?
Well, he was a diamond craftsman.
And your mother was quite a serious politician, local politician, wasn't she?
I don't know if you'd call my mother serious. I mean, she's a very clever woman.
But she became mayor, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. But she was always an independent. I mean, she was asked by each of the main parties to actually stand for Parliament at different times because she had a big local following. But she said, no, I'm an independent.
And it was a very orthodox Jewish family.
It was. My mother's side was much more orthodox than my father's side. And my mother's father was a rabbi, and he had an incredible library. I mean, we had a lot of books at home, but I mean, my father. I remember him sitting in the corner reading Balzac and chuckling. But my grandfather would be reading these in the original, and he'd read Dante in the original, which was remarkable for a real Hebrew scholar who was a great Talmudic expert, and that was very unusual. So I learned classical Hebrew and Aramaic and a bit of Chaldaic when I was quite young.
So when did medicine float into the frame?
Oh, that was very late. I think I said when I was 8 I wanted to be a famous scientist, but I mean, you know, obviously...
Well, there you are.
Well... no, I mean, I was going to read natural sciences, and then suddenly at the last moment had a crease and decided to go for medicine when I was about 19, and it was a very last-minute decision.
So you decided on medicine, you studied in London, you qualified, you got a job, you worked as a junior houseman for 4 years or more, and then you gave it all up for the theatre.
Yes, I worked, that's right, I worked for 4 years, and I was working in a very, I think, cruel environment, really. You know, the first 6 months of my first job, I left the hospital for one weekend, and after 4 years of being completely, 3 years really to be fair, being completely stultified and feeling that this was not nearly as creative as I'd expected it to be, and very regimented, I decided that I would go back to an interest which I'd always had since a teenager, which was theatre. I did a couple of things around the place, and then I got an offer of quite a good stage in Edinburgh, and I took a play up by Pirandello, which I was playwright I'm still mad about, and it was an amazing success.
Tell me about your third record.
Well, the third one is a terribly serious piece, really. It's really from a sort of oratorio, or it's called a symphony, but it's sung. It's by Noam Sharif, who's an Israeli musician, who wrote a piece called Mahaye Hametim, Revival of the Dead. It's a kind of requiem. I've always liked requiems, and this is a requiem which looks at Jews before the Holocaust, and then the Holocaust, and then the revival of Israel as a sort of nation.
Of the Holocaust from Noam Sharif's Revival of the Dead with Joseph Malavani, Levi Visser and the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by David Porcelain. It's pretty devastating music, isn't it?
It's just devastating. It's difficult really to talk about some music. I'm not actually a great Holocaust revivalist at all. In fact, actually, I think, although we have to remember the Holocaust, I think that we Jews have suffered from a Holocaust mentality, which I think is actually counterproductive. But on the other hand, there are certain things that we have to remember because they are universal. It's not just a Jewish thing. And indeed, you could argue it could be a thing that's happening in Rwanda. And you can argue that it's a thing that could happen in Palestine as well. And there is a universality, really, about that music, which is extraordinary.
What about your faith and your work, Robert? Has it given you pause for thought in the ethical arguments surrounding embryo research, for example?
Yes, I mean, that's been tremendously important. As it happens, I think Judaism has provided answers for virtually all the ethical problems that I've been faced with, and it's been a tremendously important yardstick.
But when people, you know, who obviously have equally deeply held faith but of a different kind, argue with you, criticise you publicly about the rights of the unborn child, about how wrong it is to experiment with embryos. Mm-hmm. Do you have any respect for their views, or does your faith give you an answer to all
no,
of that?
No, of course I have respect for their views. One differs from them. But that's actually what our society is about. I mean, the great thing about our society, its great strength, is that it's a pluralist society. And what's always troubled me is that people with very strong fundamentalist or deontological views have sometimes tried to impose those views on the multitude in society, and I don't think that's right.
But they might argue that your views are being imposed on society.
No, on the contrary, you see, they're not. I think the fact is that what I do as a Jew when I see patients is to use my version of what I think is right and put it to them, but I don't make that an absolute decision. I mean, for example, there are many situations that I wouldn't... There are certain many decisions that I wouldn't take for myself.
Such as?
Well, I mean, one of the great difficult areas in reproductive medicine generally is the area of terminating pregnancy, really, for example. I mean, that, you know, but that's... To my mind, that has to be solved on an individual basis. You can't enforce those rules in general for everybody. I mean...
But in your personal life, you're saying you would not have ever wanted your wife to have an abortion.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. In fact, Judaism has views about the fetus which give it increasing status as it develops. And therefore, the circumstances will have to be looked at in each case. It's the notion that there are individual judgments to be made. It's not a pyramidal religion. There isn't a single authority. And there is a possibility for flexibility, and there's a degree of pragmatism about Judaism, which I think is fundamentally very important.
More music.
Well, in the last year of his life, 1827, Schubert was very affected by Beethoven's death, and he was suffering from malaise and headaches. He had incipient syphilis, probably. And he wrote the Winterreise, the Winter's Journey, and Last Hope is the description of his watching a leaf falling from a tree, and that's his hope going. And that leaf in the dappled sunlight is just like the embryo that we transfer to the uterus, which generally doesn't actually become a baby.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Letzte Hoffnung from Schubert's Winterreise, accompanied by Gerald Moore. There are so many ethical issues surrounding the work you do, Robert Winston. One of the most controversial, I think, has to be your wish to help a woman who is HIV positive to have a baby. Why do you believe that a woman who has a potentially fatal condition, which she could possibly pass on to a child she bore, why should she have help to have a baby?
You have to understand, first of all, this isn't a general judgment. This was exactly the point. It was an individual judgment in a particular case. But I'm sure, given an individual case of similar proportions, I would feel probably the same way. Now, first of all, this woman had been well for 12 years. And there are now, increasingly, a number of women who remain perfectly well indefinitely. Secondly, I am aware of some research which strongly suggests that we might be able to kill the HIV virus, and one has to accept that sometime there will be a cure for this disease. I'm sure there will be. Thirdly, with proper precautions, the chances of the baby dying or being affected by HIV would be less than 10%, probably no more than 8%. Now, if we just translate that into a woman who's deciding whether or not to play Russian roulette, having a fatal gene defect in the family, we'd have no doubt that we would allow her to have a pregnancy, because people do that all the time. I met her several times, and I never promised her I was going to treat her until about the third or fourth time, when I was then very sure. And I then presented it to a lot of people. I mean, I discussed it with very senior colleagues, including lay people.
But it is where your playing God comes in again.
No, it's not. What I'm doing is not playing God. You see, that's wrong. Playing God would be taking an arbitrary decision. Not playing God is allowing the argument to develop and then taking what seems to be a just decision after due consideration with as many people as possible.
Record number 5.
Yeah, well, this is a different form of conception. I mean, this is genetic engineering in its ultimate form. This is Prokofiev, who's this marvellous composer. This is the poem about the desperately depressed prince who goes on this journey because he falls in love with the idea of three oranges. And he gets into the desert with his three oranges, and he cuts open the first one to get a drink, and there's this princess inside who dies, and then he opens the second orange later on because he's desperate for a drink, and she dies. And then the third time he opens the third orange, the last orange, at this point, the people who are in the theatre intervene. This is the theatre coming out in me, the idea of the theatrical. And they come in and they bring the fire bucket on and they give the princess something to drink. So this is Birth Out of an Orange, and it's the march from the love of the three oranges.
March from the Love of Three Oranges by Prokofiev, played by the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. So, do you believe then, Robert Winston, essentially your role is, if you like, to even out the playing field, to make it possible for anyone who wants a baby to have a go at having one?
No, I don't actually see myself as having a role. I mean, really, I don't. I don't see myself as being anything like that important.
What's your attitude to helping a lesbian couple have a child?
Well, I think my attitude there is simply this, that, again, I think it's a question of autonomy. And I think my feeling really is that there has to be clear evidence that there is harm to the welfare of any unborn child. And I've not seen that evidence.
So have you treated a lesbian woman?
Well, I'll tell you something. First of all, lesbian women who I've known intuitively to be lesbian have come to me with a man in tow. And what I've done when I felt it was appropriate is to be prepared to play the game. Now, lesbians are still very defensive about coming forward and asking for treatment, and it's very seldom that we get direct requests. We've had a few, but it is seldom. But I think these cases need to be looked at.
But you've treated them when they've been honest as well as when they've been dishonest.
Yes, I have treated people who've been dishonest, actually. Yes, I have. Hmm. But it's a question of why they're being dishonest and how far they're being dishonest.
But you haven't called their bluff. You've just hoodwinked them back, have you?
No, I don't think one should do that. I have to say, no matter how good you are, all doctors make mistakes. If you're a cardiac surgeon, you can kill a patient on the operating table. If you're a gynecologist, you can cause havoc removing a uterus in rare examples. And we're not immune from those mistakes. But it's ludicrous to single out reproductive medicine, which is probably more carefully policed, more carefully regulated, more thoughtful and introspective than virtually any other branch of medicine.
But you can also spend precious national health money treating people who perhaps have already had children or who are not in a permanent relationship. You know, people who perhaps shouldn't be in receipt of that money and that treatment.
Well, I don't think that's quite so easy to do nowadays, actually, because, I mean, there have been one or two cases that have cropped up, but very few, because, of course, the health service is so rigidly structured that actually what happens is that people are deprived of this treatment when they should undoubtedly have it, rather than they get it unnecessarily. And what I think is a scandal is that here we have politicians talking about family values and the need to promote the family and relationships. And at the same time, in one of the most important areas of medicine which affects the family, we make a total underprovision of a service which needn't be expensive. It could be much cheaper, providing it was better organised, providing actually the Department of Health took it on and worked out what to do.
I want to talk to you about politics in a minute, but pause for some more music.
We come, I think, to one of the finest pieces of operatic writing, the quartet in Rigoletto, where we have the Duke of Mantua singing Bella Figlia d'Amore, making love to Maddalena, who's laughing at him. And Gilda and Rigoletto are watching this scene. And it's the welding of four total different emotions: sarcastic laughter, lust portrayed as love, genuine love portrayed as despair, and vengeance by Rigoletto.
Part of the quartet from Act 3 of Verdi's Rigoletto, with Roberto Alagna, Mariana Penceva, Andrea Rost and Renato Brusson, with the chorus and orchestra of La Scala Milan, conducted by Riccardo Muti. Tell me about the future, Robert, a future in which people foresee are giving birth to, and controversial phrase, this designer babies, that's to say, children in whom the disease-carrying genes have been eradicated. You'll be able to choose the sex, you'll be able to choose what the colouring, the character, the aptitude. That's going to happen, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's just take those one by one. First of all, I've no doubt you're going to be able to choose the sex of a baby, but you won't need IVF to do that. That will be done by proper sperm sorting. Society will have to take a decision about that, because that is actually an issue which does affect society. With regard to gene defects, well, people have criticised the work that we've done. I mean, if I dare use the word pioneered, because it sounds so immodest, but let's say we started the notion that you could screen an embryo for a specific gene defect. And that work, which Alan Handyside and I did together, meant that we could prevent families who'd lost a child through a severe genetic defect in the early stages, then have a baby that was free of the defect. That seems justifiable. And it is true that we should be able to prevent certain rare cancer genes, where there's a 90% probability of developing a particular cancer. We could prevent those in due course. But desirable characteristics like beauty, intelligence, strength, I don't think the risk is nearly as serious as you say in anything like the near future. First of all, the desirable things like beauty and strength and so on, these are a multiplicity of genes interacting in an extraordinary way. And it's very unlikely we're going to be able to manipulate multiple genes in that sort of way in my lifetime or my children or my grandchildren's lifetime. I think it's a long time ahead. The other problem is this, that if you manipulate genes, which is different from screening genes out, if you start manipulating a gene, you run the risk of damaging the embryo and causing an abnormality, of having an unexplained or undesirable gene expression. Now, I don't think that any doctor could likely consider that. And I think that one of the reasons why mankind is safe from us at the moment and for some time to come is because there's the inevitable fact that the problem with this kind of genetic engineering is that it will always be unpredictable, and that's a very serious check.
Record number seven.
Record number seven. Well, this is a savage piece of music. It's Shostakovich, and it has echoes of Lady Macbeth of Matensk, his opera, because there are lots of quotations from that. And that's an opera about Russian womanhood, and particularly about an infertile woman. And the eighth quartet in the second movement has this remarkable passage, the sort of thing that Shostakovich often does, where he uses a folk melody halfway through, which is a Jewish folk melody, and he's talking about the destruction of peoples, not about Jews particularly, but about peoples and about generations.
Part of the second movement of Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, played by the Borodin String Quartet. You've just been made a Labour peer, Robert Winston. Do you see yourself becoming more politically active in a Blair government?
I shouldn't think so. Who knows?
Would you like to, though? I mean, do you see yourself would you be prepared to be spokesman on health in the Lords? Or?
I don't think I would be asked to be spokesman on health in the Lords, but...
But would you like to be?
I mean, there are a number of areas which I think I'd like to influence. I think I'd probably quite like to influence science more than medicine in some ways. I think medicine is very well spoken for in the House of Lords, as it happens. We've got an excellent spokesperson. If one could use one's limited expertise to help influence sensible decisions, that would be good. I mean, I found the House of Lords desperately depressing for the first 6 months. I wasn't.
Why?
Well, first of all, I wasn't at all sure that I should be there anyway. And then having got there, after being quite diffident about it, I felt myself just doing one other thing rather badly, you know, I mean, and not doing anything very well. I'm beginning to get a bit of the measure of the place now, I think, and it is an extraordinarily interesting place.
But enormously time-consuming for a man who doesn't
to do
have
it properly,
much time.
Yes, but then I can do my scientific writing at night and my medicine in the morning. I wouldn't mind having more to do with the arts, actually. That's always been a fundamental interest, both literature, music, painting.
So you could become Minister for Fun?
Huh. Yeah. Like, fat chance of that.
Last record.
Well, the last record really is very special. It's Johann Sebastian Bach, Goldberg Variations. And, I mean, this is an expression of ultimate fecundity because his music was fecund in the extreme. He was an extraordinarily prolific composer. He had 20 children from two wives, I think 13 from his second wife, I think that's right. And, of course, this is being played by the most precise pianist, Glenn Gould, and it's just a masterpiece of timing.
Playing the end, the aria and reprise of Bach's Goldberg Variations. If you could only take one of those 8 records, Robert.
I think it would be rather difficult not to take the Bach, really.
What about your book?
That's very difficult. I mean, I'm surrounded by books. I thought about this a lot and I haven't come to definite conclusions. But I think the Quran, actually, and perhaps if I might be allowed, it in English and Arabic, and an Arabic primer. There's a reason for that. You know, Islam gets an extraordinarily bad press in our society. I mean, the violence that we use towards Islam verbally is savage, and there's a need to understand this culture much more, and I feel that I could spend some time usefully trying to do that.
And what about a luxury?
Well, if you allow me not to use this as a utility, and I promise not to, it would be the tools and the blank glass to grind my own reflector telescope, I think. I've started trying to make reflector telescopes several times in my life and never actually had, because I'm a terrible, you know, I flit around from things. I've never finished it off. But I think on a desert island I might have the opportunity of finishing off my grinding and polishing, making a good parabolic mirror, and then being able to watch the stars afterwards.
Robert Winston, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.